New York Times Magazine ran an interesting ad paid for by a children's clothing company asking children to draw pictures of God and to send them in. They received 1,700 drawings that were submitted of what these children think that God looks like. Now, were you, even as an adult, to enter such a contest, what do you think that you would draw? Would God be old or young? Would God be male or female? Would God be friendly or mean? We recite the Apostles' Creed, saying, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. But although we say that and attest to it, don't we sometimes wonder what he looks like? I mean, haven't we at least once wanted to see God, to catch a glimpse, to take a picture, even if only for a few moments, to stare at God so that there's a lasting impression of his appearance? I think that perhaps that desire is the greatest when the calamities of life strike and it seems as if all of the circumstances are crumbling down on us, when the pain is piercing and when we are frustrated, perhaps to the point of desperation, that the physicians and the counselors cannot offer for us any remedy to the problems that we face, and we turn and we want to see God. We want to look at him in the eye and ask for his help. And if he's not ready or willing or able to help us, to at least ask him to give us an explanation of why not. I think that may somewhat have been in the mind of the Old Testament character Job when he said, if only I knew where to find him, if only I could go to his dwelling. Sensing that Job, if he had God's address, would go there and knock on the door and be able to see God. But it's not a simple thing to see the invisible God. The Bible is our primary source about God. And so it is obviously the first place to which we ought look if we are counted among those who want to see him. However, there's something of a frustration here as well, for as you read through the Bible, and especially as you check out those sections that talk about seeing God, they appear to be fraught with seeming contradictions. And I'll give you just some examples. In Exodus chapter 24 on page 125 of your Pew Bible, we come to what was one of the great high points of the spiritual history of the ancient nation of Israel. They had just entered into a covenant relationship with God. They said, you're our God. He said, you are my people. And they sealed that covenant together with sacrifices. And after they did this, 74 of their leaders walked up the mountain. And here's what they experienced. It's in Exodus 24, verses 9 through 11. Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of sapphire, clear as the sky itself. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God, and they ate, and they drank. Now, to me, that is both amazing and disappointing. Amazing that they actually got to see God, but rather disappointing that they didn't give any record of it, that one of the 74 didn't sketch a picture, that at least there should have been some type of a written description of how God appeared. Strangely, the only thing that is here said is something about the floor on which his feet stood, that it was like sapphire, only as clear as the sky. And that means that at best we figure out from it that God must have feet, and nothing is described of the rest of his appearance. There's a little more of a glimpse down in verse 17 where Moses is up on the mountain and he's conversing with God, and all the people of Israel are down below, some estimate as many as 3 million of them, and they saw something that was for them most memorable. Verse 17 of Exodus 24 says that to the Israelites, the glory of the Lord that they saw looked like a consuming fire on top of the mountain. It was an astonishing thing. But they didn't really see God. They just saw this fire that represented where God was. Unlike those 74 that the record clearly says saw God. But you page 16 pages deeper into the book of Exodus or the Old Testament to an encounter that the same Moses had with the same God, in which he said to him, "I'd like to see your face." And God said, "Well, you may be able to see my goodness. You may be able to get a glimpse of my glory. But," in Exodus 33:20, God says, "you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live." Doesn't that seem strange? Didn't we just read 16 pages back that there were 74 people who saw God? Moses was one of them, and he apparently lived so that he could have this experience that is here reported. So what's this deal? What's the deal that no one can see God and live when obviously we have a record that 74 of them saw God and they lived? Well, whatever it means, we do read here that God has a face. So we have added somewhat to his composite picture that he has feet and that he has a face. But the seeming contradictions roll on and come to a climax all the way in the New Testament book of John. John, the author of one of those four New Testament Gospels, was Jesus' closest friend. He was himself an informed Jew who knew the Old Testament well. He does, in the first chapter of John, refer back to Moses, so he knew about what was stated here in the book of Exodus. And what he's writing in the beginning of his biography of Jesus is an introduction to who God is and what is Jesus' relationship to him. Except in John 1:18, he writes these words, "No one has ever seen God." Now, wait a minute. Didn't this same Bible say that the Hebrew leaders saw God? Again, what's the deal? I mean, did they see God or did they not see God? And if you can see God, can you see him and live? Or do you get zapped dead? Or has it happened or hasn't happened? I mean, which way is it? Well, believing that the Bible is God's word and therefore is authoritative and accurate, we seek to take all of the pieces, and as difficult as they may seem to be to fit together in that puzzle, we seek to bring them together in a way that will synthesize the teachings of the Bible. Perhaps the key is found also in the Gospel of John in chapter 4, where Jesus engages in a conversation with a Samaritan woman at the community well. He starts talking to her about having a drink of water. But what started out as a rather routine conversation about a drink very quickly became a very profound conversation about God and about worship and also about her multiple marriages. So it became profound and it became personal. Anyway, in the course of this conversation with this Samaritan woman by the well, Jesus said that God is spirit. Now perhaps that's the key to our understanding and synthesizing these seeming contradictions. Spirits, of course, are real, but they are invisible. You can't see a spirit. Compare that to the radon gas that we hear so much about these days. Everyone is challenged to test, especially in the basement of your home or even an office or someplace where you spend a lot of time, to find out if there is radon gas. And those who advertise the sale of these boxes and other mechanisms for evaluating the amount of radon gas warn that radon gas is odorless, that radon gas is tasteless, and that radon gas is invisible. So you can't see it, you can't smell it, and you can't taste it. But it's there. And it's no less real because our senses don't experience it. In fact, it may be a matter of life and death whether or not that radon gas is present. And so we might compare to God, who cannot be seen, cannot be smelled, cannot be tasted, but is real and is powerful and is a person. I mean, he's no less a person because you can't see him, because he has what makes for personhood. He has intellect and emotion and will, as do we. He is a person whom we cannot see because he is a spirit. He is invisible. Now, that's disturbing to some people. Some people struggle with the notion that God does not have a body. Early in my pastoral experience, there was an elderly man in the church who was disturbed with me. And I think I would say he was distraught over the teaching of these biblical principles and truths, so much so, in fact, that he did what I suppose normally would be a flattering thing, but for me it turned out not to be that way. He wrote a book about me and couldn't find a usual publisher, so I actually took his own money and had the book published, because he concluded that I was quite the heretic. The book did not sell real well. In fact, I don't think the book sold at all. So he distributed them on car windshields during church services around town, which did get a distribution. I'm not sure how well it was read. But the gist of his argument was that if I said that God is invisible, I really don't believe that God exists, and therefore I must be an atheist. And he did not want an atheist for a pastor, and you know, that's why he wrote the book. But spirits are no less real because they can't be seen. God is a spirit. Jesus clearly stated that. That's who and that's what God is. A preacher and radio broadcaster from earlier in this century in New York City had what I think is a helpful way of coming to understanding of all this. Harry Emerson Fosdick was for many years in the national radio pulpit, and he would tell how, as a child, he would go out of doors and he would see the leaves and the branches of trees moving back and forth, and that he would feel the wind. And from his childish perspective, he analyzed it and came to a conclusion. And that was that every time the trees moved their limbs and leaves, they made the wind to blow. But then he explained that as he grew older, as he became more sophisticated in his understanding, as he became mature, he realized that the wind, which he could not see, actually moved the trees that he could see. Just as Fosdick explained, it is the invisible God that we cannot see who moves the world, which we can see. God is indeed real. But God is invisible because God is spirit. But it is possible for God as a spirit to make temporary appearances, appearances that are physically to be seen. And so, for example, in the Old Testament, and there are many examples in the Bible, he appeared as a pillar of fire to lead the Hebrew people at night, or as a cloud during the daytime, or sometimes in angelic form, or sometimes in human form. Now, there is actually a technical name for these temporary physical appearances or manifestations of God. They are called theophanies. A theophany, T-H-E-O-P-H-A-N-Y, is a temporary physical appearance of the God who is otherwise spirit and invisible. A theophany is God's way of accommodating us. It's God's way of coming to our terms and our ways. A specific appearance for a specific purpose and temporary to be sure. It's hard to know exactly what to compare to in our realm of experience to understand how God does this. I suppose you might make a comparison to an oscilloscope or to an electrocardiogram or an electroencephalogram. All of those are ways of taking invisible waves in the engine of a car or an electronic appliance at home or in a heart or in a brain, things that are invisible that can't be seen, and then making them appear on a screen, on a CRT, or on a strip of paper. And then, at least temporarily, it is possible to see that which is really invisible. It's giving an appearance for the benefit of the sight of the mechanic or the physician. But we need to be careful that we never mistakenly think that that is reality. What is seen in the oscilloscope in the garage shop when the engine is being tuned, that is not the reality that is in that engine. Or when the physician looks at that tape with all the squiggly lines on it and says that this heart is healthy or ill or that those are normal patterns for brain waves or abnormal, those aren't reality. Reality is that which is invisible. And these are merely temporary ways of seeing that which cannot normally be seen. And so let us not think that what those 74 leaders of Israel saw on top of the mountain was reality, or the cloud that led Israel, or the pillar of fire. It was not. It was simply a temporary way for God to fit into our senses. God is in who he is, in reality, in essence, spirit. God is invisible. And therefore, Jesus accurately says, no one has ever seen God. Now, with all that said, what's to be said next may seem like something of a contradiction, but it really isn't. And that is that the invisible God can be seen. I'll give you some examples. In the New Testament book of Romans, in Romans 1:20, is a verse that is something of a logical brain twister to listen to, but listen to it carefully. We're there taught that since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. Let me run that by again. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. And the principle here is a simple one. The principle here is that you can see much of the artist in the art. I, of course, have never met Michelangelo. I have no idea what the man looked like. But I've seen his art. I've seen Michelangelo's David, Michelangelo's Moses, Michelangelo's Pieta, and in those, in his sculptures, I have seen Michelangelo. Or I, like some of you, have visited the Vatican and gone on the tour and gone into the historic Sistine Chapel, the place where the decision is made when popes are elected, from which the smoke that signals the outside world is released. And there, all around the perimeter and all over the ceiling, is Michelangelo's masterpiece as he depicts God's history of the universe. It is perhaps one of the most famous pieces of art in all of the world. And so I've sat there and I've looked at it and I've read about it and studied it. And so I have seen Michelangelo in his painting. And I, again, like some of you, have walked through St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome, designed by Michelangelo. It's huge. It's magnificent. I've taken pictures of it. I've visited on several occasions. And so I have seen Michelangelo in his architecture. I've seen him in all of those different ways. In fact, it would be legitimate to say that I, in a sense, know him better and have seen him more than some whom I can now see face to face. And so it is with the invisible God, that we may see him in his stars, in his oceans, in his mountains, in his animals, in his world, in his creation, in his art. We may see the artist. We may see the creator. Or as Romans 1 says it, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. So we may see the invisible God in creation. But there's a second way the Bible explains that we may see the invisible God, and that is through his image in us. On the third page of the Bible, in Genesis 1:27, we read that God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Which is to say, then, that we can see the invisible God in ourselves, because we humans were created in God's image. Reminds me of the story of the young woman who was telling a friend how to identify her mother in picking her up at the airport. And she said, when you watch the people come off the plane, she will be the one who, when she described her in terms of age, in terms of height, in terms of weight and color of hair, the kind of clothes that she wears. But her friend recognized that that description could fit a whole lot of passengers who might be on that particular flight. A little bit frustrated, the young woman went on with her description, and she said, well, she looks like me. She said, if you've seen me, at least you have an idea of what my mother looks like. Or the man who walked into a department store. He was in the middle age, and he was walking through one of these areas where there are glass doors and then a small vestibule and then another set of glass doors, somewhat like we have for this building here. And he really wasn't thinking too much of what was going on. Walked through the first set of doors and then looked up and, in his own words, saw his father walking right at him. And then realized that he had seen his own reflection in the glass door. But you see, daughters often look like mothers, and sons look like fathers. Oh, not exactly, of course. It's not as if you can't tell the one from the other. But the image of the one can be present in the other. And so it is with God, that the image of God is in us. And so there is a sense in which we can say, do you want to know what God looks like? God looks like us. Oh, that, of course, isn't speaking of us physically, because God does not have a physical image. God is not black or white. God is not male or female or tall or short in any of those physical senses. God is a spirit, and spirits don't have bodies. But rather, it is to say that we are created in God's moral image. That's why we're able to love, and that's why we want to be loved. That's why we're able to think. That's why we're able to choose. All of that is the image of God reflected in us. It's not an exact image, because you see, sin has marred the image of God in us, torn it apart, damaged it. But it's still possible to see. I mean, you know that there are things that are damaged, and you can still figure out what they originally look like. Famous statue of Venus de Milo with no arms, discovered in, I think, 1820. The arms were then missing, and so there's no record of what she looked like originally. But you can look at that statue, you can pretty well figure it out, even though some of the pieces are there missing. Or you could look at the Colosseum in Rome, where the top layer is sort of broken off about halfway around. But you can figure out what it looked like. Couple thousand years back, you can imagine if that layer was intact. You can hear that it was once covered with an expensive covering, a lot of ivory and gold, and you can sort of fill that in your imagination. And even though what you have now is broken and marred, you can understand it. Or you go into the old trunk in the attic of your house or down in the basement. You take out some family pictures, faded, stained, maybe some of them even torn. Nothing like what they first were like, but you can still recognize who's there. You can still, even with a damaged picture, have a good impression of what that person really looks like. And so it is that there is enough of the image of God left in us humans for us to see what God is like. What is God like? He's like us, only without sin. He's like us, less our weaknesses. He's like us, only perfect. So we may see God through creation, through the image of God in humans, and best and most important of all, we may see the invisible God in Jesus. In John 1:14, we are told that the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. In many ways, that is the most important Christmas verse of them all. For while it's very interesting that Jesus was born of a virgin named Mary and placed in a manger, and there wasn't room in the inn, and his birth was announced by angels, and he was visited by shepherds and magi, and it's all very interesting and very important. But the really big news is not any of that news. The really big news is that God became flesh. It's called the incarnation, Latin for in flesh. For until that moment, take all of the billions upon billions of years of eternity as far back as forever, and there was God the Father Spirit, and God the Father Son, and God the Holy Spirit, but all Spirit. And then in an absolutely unexplainable and unique way and moment, deity and humanity were united in the person of Jesus. It was and is the greatest miracle ever accomplished. And so on that first Christmas, Mary became much more than the mother of a new baby. Mary, that Christmas day, became the first person ever to see God. With unfocused eyes, with unscrubbed skin. He was there. She saw God. Not just Mary, but Joseph. And the shepherds. And eventually the Magi. And eventually thousands and thousands of others saw God in human flesh. Now I'll tell you something that I find to be absolutely startling. That not one of them, at least as the records go, drew a picture of him. No one wrote even a single word about what he looked like. Well, you've got to remember that he fed thousands of people. Recall that they said that this man spoke like no other man has ever spoken. That he performed powerful miracles, making the congenitally lame able to walk, the congenitally blind able to see, the dead come back to life. I mean, these people worshipped him. They were willing to die for him, and in fact, many of them did die for him, but they never left a word about what he looked like. I can come to no other conclusion. They didn't think it mattered. It didn't make any difference what he looked like. Because who he was and what he was and all that he did far overshadowed any physical characteristic. They saw God, but they didn't write a word of his physical appearance. Now, it's true that we today cannot physically see Jesus. But we can see him. We can see him the same way they saw him. Soul to soul. Not with eyes, but with faith. And those who come to him now in faith will actually someday, physically, see him face to face. How does all that work? Well, let me explain. That when God became human, it was not so much a matter of sight as it was of salvation. For he came to remedy our horrendous dilemma over sin. For in our sin, we're destined to damnation and hopeless in terms of self-remedy. But that baby Jesus grew to maturity, and as a man, he died on the cross. And in his perfection, he paid the price for our sin. Asking that we simply accept what he has done, accept him as Savior, and commit to him as Lord. It is not something that we do so much as a matter of physical sight or written record, but it is our soul to his spirit that we pray, as you may choose here now to pray, and say, God, I am just the sinner I've heard described, and I accept you, Jesus, as my Savior and as my Lord. And once that transition takes place, that we then are born anew because of our faith in him, we then experience God. We see God. And someday, in heaven, the guarantee is we will see him face to face.
Jay and Denise Ford come this morning to share with us their faith story. We welcome them to our pulpit this morning. Thank you.
Jay and I started dating in high school at the end of our senior year. We had been dating about 4 months when we each went away to college. Jay went to Indiana University, and I went to Messiah College in Pennsylvania. We agreed to continue dating, but I didn't think it would last long because our backgrounds were too different and Jay was not a Christian. I wanted to be in a relationship in which God could be the center. God would be our common bond. Jay had come to a few senior high church activities with me in the summer and was receptive but made no serious commitment. We visited each other's schools and saw each other on breaks. The next summer, I realized things were getting serious, so I had better give some more serious thought to our relationship. I was raised in a Christian home by Christian parents and accepted Christ at the age of 12 in our church's Bible school. My mom was the biggest influence on my spiritual life. Things were not always easy for her, but she consistently put Christ first in her life. He helped her through the tough times. She influenced me by her actions more than her words. Since I did not want to marry someone who was not a Christian and our relationship seemed to be heading in that direction, I took it upon myself to get to work on Jay. I wanted to marry someone who would put Christ first in their lives. Marriage was intended to fulfill God's purpose for us, to add meaning to the relationship between a husband and a wife. I tried many tactics over the next few months and years. I brought him to several non-threatening activities at church. We went to a few college and career Bible studies and several church services. I even sent him a Bible at school. I had him find a passage that I had highlighted, 1 Corinthians 13, the chapter on love. I did this to get him to flip through the Bible and to have him see what God intended true love to be. I also gave him a devotional book to go with it. And then I asked him every single night if he was reading his Bible. This didn't work. Eventually he came around and he did accept Christ. It did not happen as I thought it would. I expected a magnificent sign from God, like lightning coming down from the heavens. But nothing like this happened. He just quietly accepted Christ. But the important thing was that he did accept Christ. This all took a great deal of time and patience for both of us. He asked a lot of questions, and he wanted to understand. And I wanted him to become a Christian in my time. I needed to wait for God's time. I had to depend and trust in God. We moved to Minnesota from New Jersey a little over a year ago and have been coming to Wooddale since September of 1989. We feel fortunate to have found Wooddale and are growing together and learning each day.
If 6 years ago someone came up to me and told me that I would be in front of a group full of people in church and be professing my faith, or if they told me that I would have a personal relationship with God, honestly, I wouldn't have believed them. But here I am today to tell you my story. As Denise said, in April of 1985, we started dating. With the help of her and her family, my life slowly changed. Denise's brother, David, also had an important role in my spiritual life. At first, I was very intimidated about going to church. because I did not know what was going on, and I felt very dumb. He brought me into the church through less threatening activities, such as playing basketball and softball, and I soon became friends with many people in the church. I felt much more comfortable there, because I learned that it was okay not to know everything, and that the friends I met were there to help me. That is when Denise took over by teaching me about God and Jesus. Though we had many hard times, she never gave up on me. It was almost 2.5 years later that I accepted Jesus into my heart, and with this knowledge, it has given me real enthusiasm in life. Since athletics was one way I originally came to church, I know the importance of having a good athletic program. That is the reason I'm on the athletic ministry board here at Wooddale, whose major purpose is to get people to come to Wooddale in a non-threatening atmosphere and help them to get to know the Lord. Even though Denise and I started out as different as two people can be, we ended up very similar because we now realize we have a lot in common through the Lord. Everyone here has a family member or a friend who does not know the Lord. Never give up on them, because if I can change, anyone can.